Second John, Third John, and First John, chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 2, verse 2, the first talk in a series on the Apostle John's three letters, was presented by Colin Stetter on October 29, 2017, at Reformation Fellowship.
The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2017. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
A translation of 1 John by Colin Stetter accompanies this talk.
Well, hello. Appreciate you guys all taking the time to be here. So, as Jack did reference, I was a student at Gutenberg. I graduated from there in 2004 and did my thesis on Marx and Solzhenitsyn and kind of looking at their theories of what makes human beings and what makes us tick and what our problem is. I was a regular attender here at Reformation back then and took some time to go away, do some studies at Marquette in philosophy, and then came back here in 2010. We've been here since. So this has been a really fantastic project for me, getting to work with Jack over the last couple of years on translating 1 John and learning a little bit better how to use, you know, tools of the Greek language, understanding the language and how it's being used here, and trying to come to grips with what the author is saying in this letter. What was the context? There's a lot of wonderful things that I think we need to do business with. So my own personal journey as a Christian, at least culturally, began back in grade school when I started going to, you know, your big conventional evangelical non-denominational box church. And it was a wonderful experience for me as a kid, you know, trying to find a sense of identity. And a lot of my identity, at least in those early years, was really wrapped up in my usefulness to God. Christianity was about evangelism, and we're here to go out there and share the gospel and make converts. And I was good at it. And for a lot of years, I saw fruit come out of that. I was pretty darn good at convincing people that it was in their best interest to pray that prayer with me right now and seal that deal with God. And it gave me a lot of, you know, sense of personal satisfaction and peace of mind that, you know, God was with me and I was doing the good work and on the right side, and that was what life was about. But the tricky thing was when I started to get a little older, and two things happened. One, I started to realize that a lot of the motivations for doing what I was doing, you know, weren't the best. A lot of it came down to feeding my own sense of self-importance and wanting to have that experience of being the person who God was using in that moment. Fortunately for me, the frequency within which God used me to be that person was decreasing quite a bit as I was getting older. And so I kind of had a crisis of faith or crisis of identity, you know, where for me it was a huge question, am I really doing what I'm supposed to be doing? Do I really understand what God wants of me and who I'm supposed to be? Do I really have an accurate understanding of the gospel and what it means to truly be a follower of Christ? So that was a huge question in my life, and it's taken a lot of years to begin to resolve that. I think that the church to whom John is writing these letters is finding themselves in a similar position. They're having a similar crisis, and some of the same questions are coming up for them, not for the same reasons, but those questions of, are we really on the right track? How do we know whether we truly have fellowship with God? How do we know if the Father is with us? How do we know if we're on the right track and believing the right things, doing the right things. How do we know that? Those same questions of identity, I think, were foremost in their mind. And I think we can get a good idea for why those questions had come up for them by looking at 1 John, or actually 2 and 3 John. So let's turn to that real quick. So in 2 John, he writes, "The elder," and I think that's John there, "to the lady," and I think the lady is the church to whom he's writing, "chosen by God and her children," those are the individual believers that are part of the church, "whom I love in truth, and not I alone, but all who know the truth, for the sake of the truth that dwells among us and will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace shall be with us from God the Father and from Jesus Christ, the Son of the Father, in truth and love. I was delighted to find that some of your children are living by the truth, as we were commanded by the Father. And now I have a request to make of you. Do not think that I am giving a new command. I am recalling the one we have had before us from the beginning. Let us love one another. And love means following the commands of God. Now this is the command which was given to you from the beginning to be your rule of life." So he's writing to them out of a confidence that they are people who truly do, A, know the truth, and B, have an interest in following it. And that message, he's confident, was transmitted to them. It's the message that they had originally from the beginning. So he's going to remind them of that, or has, by reminding them to love one another and follow the commands of God. "But many deceivers have gone out into the world who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as being," I think, "the Christ who has come in the flesh. These are the persons described as Antichrist, the arch deceiver. Beware of them so that you may not lose all we worked for, but receive your reward in full." So these false teachers now have come into the church and really turned their world upside down. And these people are the primary group that he's going to be writing to them concerning. "Anyone who runs ahead too far and does not stand by the doctrine of the Christ is without God. He who stands by that doctrine possesses both the Father and the Son." This is what they're really interested in. Do we have fellowship with the Father? And what he is concerned with is that they remain committed to the Son. If they have the Son, they have the Father. "If anyone who comes to you does not bring that doctrine," these are the false teachers he has in mind, "do not welcome him into your house or give him a greeting. For anyone who gives him a greeting is an accomplice in his wicked deeds. I have much to write to you, but I do not care to put it down in black and white. But I hope to visit you and talk with you face to face so that our joy may be complete. The children of your sister," and I think he's talking now about his church, "chosen by God, send their greetings." So that, in a nutshell, is basically an abstract of what he's going to be exploring at length in 1 John. Unfortunately, as we're going to see in 3 John, that letter didn't have such success in making it to his audience. So let's look at 3 John real quick. "The elder to dear Gaius, whom I love in truth." Okay, so now he's addressing this to one particular individual in that church. "My dear Gaius, I pray that you may enjoy good health, and that all may go well with you, as I know it goes well with your soul. I was delighted when friends came and told me how true you have been. Indeed, you are true in your whole life. Nothing gives me greater joy than to hear that my children are living by the truth. My dear friend, you show a fine loyalty in everything that you do for these, our fellow Christians, strangers though they are to you. They have spoken of your kindness before the congregation here. Please help them on their journey in a manner worthy of the God we serve. It was on Christ's work that they went out, and they would accept nothing from pagans. So we are bound to support such men and so play our part in spreading the truth." So we're getting a picture of a situation that has arisen where John, aware of the situation in this congregation, has tried to speak to it, has tried to speak into it directly. And so he must have sent a letter or a messenger, you know, to speak, authorized to speak in his stead to this church. And unfortunately, some of these people, these prominent false teachers or prominent people in the church that are in agreement with the false teachers, they did not allow these messengers from John to speak and to share their message. But when these guys return to John, they do report that, look, this fellow Gaius, he is friendly to you. He is faithful to the original teaching, and he is interested in what you have to say. So John sends this packet, I think, with this letter addressed specifically to Gaius, this man he knows whom is faithful to him now directly, with a request. I sent a letter to the congregation, but Diotrephes, their would-be leader, will have nothing to do with us. If I come, I will bring up the things that he is doing. He lays baseless and spiteful charges against us. Not satisfied with that, he refuses to receive our friends, and he interferes with those who would do so and tries to expel them from the congregation. So these are serious charges. I mean, this is behavior that's absolutely antithetical to somebody who would claim to represent the truth or somebody who's interested in living out the love that we know is at the heart of the gospel and the heart of what it is to be obedient to God. My dear friend, do not imitate bad examples, but good ones. The well-doer is a child of God. The evil-doer has never seen him. Demetrius gets a good testimonial from everybody, and I'm guessing that Demetrius is the messenger who has brought this packet to Gaius. Yes, and from the truth itself. I add my testimony, and you know that my testimony is true. I have much to write to you, but I do not care to set it down with pen and ink. I hope to see you very soon, and we will talk face to face. Peace be with you. Our friends send their greetings. Greet our friends one by one. So John is clearly alarmed by the situation and hopes to come in person to address some of these things. But in the meantime, he sent this letter, which I think is 1 John. So that, I think, in a nutshell, is the context into which he's writing, and we need to have that in the back of our heads the whole time, because that context really informs much of what he's going to be writing here. A lot of what he's going to say in this letter has relevance both on the surface and then in context, also often as sort of an aside to the false teachers and the situation, the contextual situation that we know he's writing into. So, okay, so let's look at 1 John itself then. So section 1, which I think corresponds to chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, is an introduction and statement of purpose. So having seen and heard and handled with our own hands what was the original teaching concerning how one may attain to life in the final age, we now proclaim to you that same message of life in the final age, once known only to the Father. It was manifested among us, and we saw it and testify to it. Our hope is that what we proclaim to you of what we have seen and heard will result in your having fellowship with us. And indeed, this ought to be of great interest to you, as our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus the Christ. So we write to you in order that your hope of attaining life may be fulfilled. So right off the bat, if you guys are familiar with your typical English translation, you may notice that is a little bit different. Some of the order of some of the statements has been moved a bit. It's a very paraphrastic translation in a number of places. So what I've tried to do is really bring out what I think is a lot of the motivation behind which he's saying what he's saying, and making that clear in how I'm translating this. And if you look at it side by side with, say, you know, your New American Standard, it'll really be clear where I've made those decisions. But any translation, obviously, that you work with, those decisions have to be made. So my hope is that you'll roll with me, and to whatever extent it's different from what you're familiar with, or to whatever extent it is similar to what you're familiar with, that'll neither, you know, be a recommendation or a source of dissuasion, but that ultimately you'll take this and go back to the scripture and compare it to what you know is true and to what the scriptures are saying and judge it by that measure. So we have in the first, like right off the bat, we've got a problem here. This is a very unusual letter in which it starts with, you know, this neuter article, it. And the big question is, well, what's the antecedent? What's he talking about? What is the it that he says was from the beginning? There's a number of options. A lot of translations translate it as, you know, that which was from the beginning, and it has this almost Genesis-like echo. So a lot of people are, you know, wondering, okay, is he referencing that, or is this similar to how he starts his gospel? A lot of people think that, well, because he goes on to start talking about something that he was in contact with, that he saw and handled and heard, and it's connected with the Son and the words of life, he must be talking about Jesus there. So it's some sort of statement of the preeminence and preexistence of Christ. But I think it makes most sense to look at what he's talking about as being the message of life itself. That's what he's going to go on to connect it to. What we saw, what we heard, what we touched and handled concerning the words of life. And this is really what he's going to be concerned with throughout the letter, is reminding them of what was that message that you as a church received originally. What was the gospel that sent you on this journey, that communicated to you who this man Jesus was, what the purpose of his life and ministry was all about, what it was that he wanted of us, and how his life and ministry was central to our receiving mercy before God. So I think that teaching then is what he has in mind. That's the it. It's the words of life, how it is that we may find life in the final age. So about those words, he seems to want to make it abundantly clear that he was in a position, such a position where he was there as an eyewitness, where he saw, he understood, he heard, he handled. I don't know if all of those are meant to be literal, how you handle the word of life with your hands, but I think that how we're meant to receive this is as a picture of intimacy. It's a powerful intimacy that is the foundation of his authority as an apostle to speak about how it is that he knows what Jesus taught and how Jesus lived and why they should listen to him, because he was there. And these words are really the words of how to attain to life in the final age. So what is the final age? I think what he's referring to is that time when God has promised that he will make of his people a great nation that turns to him, where every heart is going to be sanctified, and it's truly going to be a holy nation where Jesus is their king. And all those promises that were made from the patriarchs up through Jesus finally reach their fruition. And that's the place where you want to be. Because that kingdom is going to be an eternal kingdom. So he says of this life in the final age that it was once known only to the Father, but it was manifested among us, and we saw it and testified to it. What does he mean there, that it was once known only to the Father? I think what he has in mind is that, you know, for most of Israel's history, there is this sense that God had given them a system by which they could appeal to him for mercy. And it was a system that was oriented around the nation, and specifically oriented around the Day of Atonement, where the high priest would go into the temple, into the Holy of Holies, and he would advocate on behalf of the people for mercy from God. But this was, you know, this was done, I think, rightly in a spirit of fear of the holy God, fear that their fate as a people was in his hands, and that if they didn't keep up their end of the bargain, it was promised that they wouldn't be his people. And there were many points in Israel's history where that was the case, where God essentially wiped his hands of them and judge them as a nation. And what a terrifying position to be in if you were an individual Jew who is trying to be faithful to God and who is seeking mercy from him, and yet, you know, either the nation was corrupt because of its embrace of the polytheism of the surrounding nations, or it was being led by a high priest who was only out for profit, for himself, for gain. I mean, what is to recommend this guy to being the one to go in and to appeal to God on their behalf? Is God really going to listen to this guy? What about, you know, in a period in Israel's history where the temple isn't there, where it's not functioning, where the sacrifices aren't going on? I mean, David himself, you know, echoed the sentiment in the Psalms where, you know, he gave voice to that feeling that, you know, I want mercy from you. There has to be mercy from you. You're a merciful God. But it seems like this system that you've set up can't be the basis. It can't be the grounds. There must be some other sacrifice. There must be some other way that you have ordained by which mercy can be attained from you. But it was hidden. They didn't know what that mechanism was. And I think that's what John's talking about right there. How it was that God would affect a solution to their problem, how mercy would be attained for them, not for a year at a time, you know, not with the question of, is he going to listen to this schmuck of a guy who's our high priest at the moment, but in a way that I as an individual can have confidence, you know, yes, God has offered me mercy and I will receive it. So that was through Jesus. He was the one who God had foreordained would be, through his life, through his perfect life, his sacrifice, through his ministry, be the one qualified to be the high priest who would stand before God after having offered himself as that propitiatory offering and advocate on our behalf, who would be that perfect high priest who is qualified because of his sinless life. And he's the one, and he's the mechanism through which mercy will be obtained for each one of us. So that's what was hidden prior with the Father, that mechanism, how it's going to happen, which was now revealed to us through Jesus and his life and his ministry and his teaching, and which John was in a position to see, to hear, to witness, to interact with, to be taught by, and now be in a position to communicate to this church. So his hope is that what we proclaim to you of what we have seen and heard will result in your having fellowship with us. So really, I mean, John's hope is that they'll take seriously the position that he's coming from, speaking to them out of, that they'll listen to him, that they'll embrace what he has to say, because by embracing that teaching, they will have fellowship with him. And that fellowship, I think, is a common understanding of the truth, a common commitment to it. And that common commitment then marks them out as people who will be part of that kingdom, who will receive grace and mercy from the Father. So John claims that this should be of great interest to you, his readers, because his fellowship, John's fellowship, is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus the Christ. So we write to you in order that your hope of attaining life may be fulfilled. Now, some of you may be familiar with most English translations have, I write this to you so that my joy may be complete. There is precedent for that. I think I'm reminded of that verse in Philemon where the author talks about the joy that he has knowing that they share the truth in common and that they are of one mind together. And that joy, I think, is really a kind of psycho-emotional experience of satisfaction and joyfulness in the fact that they are, you know, they're people who share this truth in common. They have the same understanding. The truth that is so dear to me is also dear to you. And the result of that, of holding to that truth, which is life, is going to be shared by me and it's going to be shared by you. There was another possibility, though. One of the verses that I memorized as a kid was the opening of Hebrews 12, where Paul recommends that we set our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. And the thing that's always struck me about that verse is that if anyone was qualified to feel a sense of joy in being somebody who knew the truth and was destined for life, you know, surely it was Jesus, right? But the way that Paul captures that is the joy is something that was still in the distance for him. It was something he looked forward to. Is at the end of his race. I don't think that the joy there that he's talking about is a psycho-emotional experience that Jesus would have been having, but it seems to be what he then says at the end of those verses. He was, you know, lifted up and placed at the right hand of the throne of God. So his joy there seems to be the fulfillment of his destiny, his telos. His joy is finally being brought up to glory and seeing God glorified through his life, God glorified through accepting his sacrifice and making him the high priest and advocate that all of history had been pointing towards. So we have a different telos, obviously, than Jesus. I mean, we're not called to make the same sacrifice, and we're not qualified to be the high priest that he is. But we do share something in common such that we hope one day, if we are in the truth and have fellowship with the Father, to be raised to glory as Jesus was. We hope to be transformed and to share in his likeness. John's going to come back to this in his letter. And I think it makes a lot of sense to me that's the joy that John's talking about here. There's a kind of interesting side note is that the Greek for that, which is kara, is used as the root for the word that is used to describe the mark of the beast, a karagma. It's a mark or an etching, and the same root is used to describe a tool that's used for etching or for carving. And if you think about it, you know, if the mark that sets somebody aside as belonging to Antichrist is a joy in a way, and our joy is a fruit of the Spirit, right? Peace, patience, love, all that. Our joy is one of those signs that sets us off as belonging to God. It's one of the ways in which God, through our sanctification, makes us to resemble him. And that setting us apart and making us resemble him is going to find its fullest expression in that ultimate transformation that we one day look forward to. But which does he have in mind here? Which makes the most sense in the context? Well, I think that, you know, if here in this section, John's really interested in introducing himself, you know, not, "Hi, I'm John," but "I'm an apostle who is in this position, and being that, I'm in a position where I can speak into the situation that you're facing and speak authoritatively and settle these questions that you have on your mind because I was there and I can provide an authoritative counterpoint to the arguments of these false teachers." And if part of the hope that he has is that they'll listen to him and share in fellowship with him, then it makes a lot of sense to me that his focus then continues to be the benefit for them that he offers, the benefit that they can realize by listening to him and embracing what he has to say. So I think it makes more sense, and it would be more powerful to his audience that in reading this, rather than hearing, "Hi, I'm John, this is where I'm from, this is what qualifies me, this is why you should listen to me, and I'm writing this to you so that, you know, my joy can be fulfilled by knowing that you know, I went to the trouble of addressing your situation. I think it'd be much more impactful to them if what they were hearing was, John, as an apostle, have this to say to you because I can speak authoritatively into your situation, and it behooves you to listen to what I have to say and to embrace it, because if you do so, you'll have fellowship with the Father, and your destiny as children of God will come to fruition. It'll be fulfilled. Okay, anybody have any questions at this point?
His first pass at authenticity is what we've seen, heard, and touched, and his mm-hmm. second pass is just seen and heard.
Mm-hmm.
Why did he drop the touched? Why do you think he dropped the touched?
That's a good question.
I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. There is so much that I'm, like, every single time I come back to this, I'm rethinking passages and rethinking the way that he's using certain things. So my understanding is still, you know, really in development as well. When I was teaching through this at Gutenberg, Chris Swanson raised the question, well, could he be speaking about both Jesus and what he had to teach, you know, and kind of like purposefully not separating those things out, you know, preaching Christ and him crucified in a way, such that that would make sense of the touched, because, you know, he was in physical proximity to Jesus, the man, and it would also make sense of the what have I seen and heard, i.e. what did he teach? And it's possible that that could make sense of it, that he kind of has both in mind, that they're both kind of inextricably wedded together in that first statement. And then in the second, he's narrowing his focus down a little bit more to now, what was it that Jesus specifically taught us concerning how one may attain to life in the final age? I think that's possible. The other way you have to go is you have to take the touched in that first verse as being metaphorical in a way. You know, it's really just he wants to use that as a way of capturing his closeness to that teaching and the intimacy that he had with its initial transmission. And some of those words in the Greek kind of work that way, like seen. I mean, it's used both as a way of capturing what you see physically with your eyes, but it's also often used as a way to capture what you understand, what you grasp intellectually. I think that it's going to be clear that as we go through the letter, what John's really interested in is the teaching and what the content of the teaching is, and reminding them specifically of the teaching that they themselves received originally as a church. So, I mean, I think that should inform how we understand, you know, what is he concerned with reminding them of here?
Yeah, I understand you're thinking the second letter was written first and the third letter was second and the first letter is third. Is that what I understand you're saying?
More that the first, second, and third all went together as a packet. But the second, it refers to an earlier attempt of John's to speak into the situation. So that could be First John, or it could have been a different letter. It might not have even been a letter. It might have been an emissary from the church in Jerusalem who tried to go and speak on behalf of the apostles. So,
Colin, I have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is about the, in verse 4, the hour.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're taking it as it's the people he's writing to, their joy. Is there like a textual variant there, or are you taking the hour like my joy and your joy? Mm-hmm. So it's our joy as believers, basically, which you could take as their joy, because we already know he has joy.
Yeah, I should have mentioned that there is a textual variant that does have your instead of our, mm-hmm. and I'm going with that one.
Okay. Then my second question is, we don't... there's no indication, is there? We don't know who the church is that he's writing to.
Right.
So, and do we know when he wrote these letters?
I think during his life. That's my best guess. Yeah.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, because I'm involved in a Revelation study, and mm-hmm. he wrote to seven churches.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if there's any indication that it could be one of the churches mm-hmm. of the seven that he wrote to in Revelation.
I don't know. I don't know Revelation well enough to be able to connect those dots. Do you know? No.
Well, I guess I'm asking because you said he was writing from Jerusalem,
mm-hmm.
and that was like a different period of his life than mm-hmm. than later on when he was writing. Well, he was on Patmos when he was mm-hmm. writing to the seven churches, and I was just curious mm-hmm. if you knew.
You know, I wish that there was more information with respect to who the specific church was, a timeline, but we just don't have that. So.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's look at section 2. Okay, so this, I think, corresponds to the second half of chapter 1 and the first couple of verses of chapter 2. And this is where John now kind of switches gears, and he's going to directly, as an apostle, speak into the situation that's facing this church from his perspective as an apostle. So this is the essence of the teaching that we receive from Jesus himself and now proclaim to you, that God is the source of all truth and righteousness, and that to be in fellowship with him, and I think the him there is Jesus, is to embrace the truth and to renounce all evil. It follows then that anyone who claims to have fellowship with Jesus and yet fails to embrace the truth and renounce evil deeds must lie and not live in keeping with the truth. But if we live in keeping with the truth, seeking to emulate the life and teaching of Jesus, then we have fellowship with the Father, and we know that the blood of his Son Jesus cleanses us from all unrighteousness. If, as a manifestation of one's failure to embrace the truth, one claims to be without sin and thus without need of Jesus' intercession, such a one deceives themselves and the truth is not in them. However, if we confess our transgressions, he has promised to forgive us and cleanse us from all our unrighteousness. Such is his righteousness. On the other hand, if we claim not to need his mercy, then we make him a liar, and his teaching is not in us. Let me be clear, I am not writing this to you so that you may feel licensed to sin, though if anyone should fall to temptation, we have an advocate on our behalf with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. He is the propitiation for our sins, and not only for ours, but for the whole world also. So this first verse that I put as the lead-in into this next section, I'm not 100% committed to having it here. It could very well be connected to the section that we just left as a summary statement of, you know, let me, in a nutshell, remind you of what that original teaching was that leads to life in the final age. Or it could be now, as I address the situation with the false teachers, let me make this statement about what is at the heart of the gospel, because it's going to have implications that are significant to your situation, and I'm going to tease some of those implications out. So I happen to put it, I favored the latter, and I put it here, but just know that I think that it could go either way, and it's not really going to impact the meaning of the letter. So, but all things aside, it seems that what he's getting at here is that at the very root of what they need to understand is that God is the source of all truth, the Father is the source of all truth and righteousness, and that to be in fellowship with Jesus, as these false teachers I think are claiming, this is going to become more clear as we go on, has the implication that you ought to be living a life that embraces the truth and renounces evil. So the tricky thing is that in English, the way that that's rendered is that God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. What does that mean? I mean, that's something that baffled me for a long time, and I kicked around a lot of different possibilities for what he could be talking about there. Because it almost sounds like he's saying something that's tautological. God is light, okay, I can get behind that. You know, God is truth, God is the one who illuminates our way, God is the source of truth. And in him there's no darkness. Well, wasn't that really something that was already contained in what you just said? Like, how does that add anything to what you just said? And how does that really speak into the situation that he's writing into? But if he's writing into a situation where there's false teachers who have come into this church claiming, hey, you know, we came from the church in Jerusalem. We were around when Jesus was ministering and doing his thing. We remember what he was about and what he taught. We have fellowship with him. If they're claiming that and yet teaching a different gospel to this congregation, then it's incredibly powerful for John to come and say, look, God alone, the Father, is the source of truth and righteousness. And if you're going to have fellowship, if you're going to claim to have fellowship with Jesus, then you're going to be living a life that's in conformity with God the Father's values, a life in conformity with the truth, and a life that's seeking righteousness. And as we've seen from 3 John, it doesn't seem like these false teachers are living that way at all. The kind of behavior that we have a report of is that they've actively denied the messengers from the church in Jerusalem, the messengers from the apostles themselves, access to teach at the church. And furthermore, they've actually been putting people out of the church who want to hear from the apostles, who want to embrace the authentic message of what Jesus had to teach from the apostles themselves. So, I mean, that's huge. And this is behavior that not only has social ramifications for the people that were put out of the church, but this had some pretty serious, possibly physical ramifications for the messengers that John sent. I mean, remember that he described them as people that went asking nothing from the Gentiles, people that were counting on hospitality, counting on having their physical needs met by the church that they were going to minister to. They were banking on being given food, being welcomed in, being given a place to stay, and they were denied that. That's a tough position to be in this time in the world where, you know, there's no credit cards and there's no, you know, Super 8 motel down the road that you can go stay in. So it follows then, he says, that anyone who claims to have fellowship with Jesus, as I think the false teachers are claiming, and yet fails to embrace the truth and renounce evil deeds must lie and not live in keeping with the truth. So he's condemning these false teachers flat out. He's saying, look at their life, look at what they're committed to, look at what they're not committed to. That right there puts a lie to their claim. And that's what you need to know about them. But if we live in keeping with the truth, seeking to emulate the life and teaching of Jesus, then we have fellowship with the Father. And that's really what this congregation is interested in. They want to know that that's who they have fellowship with. And so that's what John is advocating that they do. Emulate the life and teaching of Jesus. Live in keeping with the truth. And we know that the blood of his son Jesus then cleanses us from all unrighteousness. So that's their hope, and that's the mechanism for how they can be sure that Jesus and his blood will cleanse them from unrighteousness. They have to live in keeping with the truth and emulate Jesus' life. But if, as a manifestation of one's failure, now I think this is back to the false teachers, one's failure to embrace the truth, one claims to be without sin and thus without need of Jesus' intercession, such a one deceives themselves and the truth is not in them. I think that we're going to see as we go along that this is a really odd and kind of particular group of false teachers. He's going to describe them as having gone out from them, the church in Jerusalem, but not being of them. He's going to seem to refer to them as claiming to have fellowship with Jesus, and yet not actually living with and keeping with the truth or embracing the truth. He's going to talk about them as being committed to sin and thus being lawbreakers. There's all these clues that we have to kind of put together because he doesn't tell us directly what it is that the false teachers were teaching or what they were advocating for. But I think as we go along and as we put some of these clues together, the picture that we get is that this is a group of teachers who were around for at least part of Jesus' ministry so that they can make the claim that they knew him or represent or were present for some of what he taught. But they seem to be people who have taken Jesus and his teaching and kind of taken it apart and decided, well, we like this bit, but we don't like this bit. And the bits they don't like are those troublesome aspects like the fact that he got himself crucified and, you know, the fact that eventually his ministry didn't actually come to look anything like the Messiah that they were hoping for. And the parts that they seem to be hanging on to and be attracted to are those parts earlier in his ministry, specifically when he went and was baptized by John in the Jordan and seemed to be putting his stamp of approval on the John the Baptist's ministry, which was a ministry of repentance and return to the law, the Mosaic Covenant. So I think it makes the most sense that these false teachers are saying, well, you know, Jesus is all well and good, but what you need to understand about him is that he wasn't actually the Messiah, but he was a good rabbi, and what he advocated for was that we follow John and his example of repenting and upholding the Mosaic Law, and in doing so, that's how we're going to have fellowship with the Father. And you can see how that would be very attractive because they have the weight of culture and history behind them. So I think that then John's comment here of if one claims to be without sin makes a little more sense, right? I mean, central to Jesus' ministry was that we as individuals have to confront, have to come to terms with the fact that we're broken human beings, each one of us. We are sinful to the core. You know, not only, and our evidence isn't just, you know, the fact that we have a record of our own actions to look at, but it's the deeper than that. I mean, we're people who, in our desires, in our thoughts, in our orientation, we are at heart hostile to God. We are hostile to the truth. And we are desperately in need of mercy. That's an uncomfortable truth to wrestle with. And it's something that we as human beings would rather not do, I think. And I think it's easier to discount and discredit the source of such a message than to really work with it and face into it. And I think that's part of what they're doing with Jesus and his life and ministry. And I think that we as human beings, we seek the comfort of a system that offers us a way to, you know, measure our standing with God based on things that we can do concretely, a performative religion with rules that we can follow, with boxes that we can check off, that doesn't require things like faith. Faith is uncomfortable. Because faith means that we have to put our trust in God and God upholding his promises. Not that we can bank on our own ability to uphold a performance. And I think that that may be insightful as to why they preferred to go back to the Mosaic Covenant as a way of seeking fellowship with God rather than taking seriously the gospel of faith that Jesus came into the world to teach us about. But if then they're serious about going back to the Mosaic Covenant, and the Mosaic Covenant is all about how they as a people can purify themselves, make themselves a holy people, set apart for a holy purpose, then it would make sense that they would say of themselves, well, in upholding this law, we are making ourselves holy as a people and without sin. We are people who are, you know, qualified to be the people of God. But John's rejoinder to them is, well, if that's how you see yourself, then you're deceiving yourself, and the truth is not in you. Because what we know from Jesus and his ministry is that all of us are in need of his intercession. All of us are in need of his mercy. Now, I can't tell if this next verse is John saying, let me remind you of how one then receives mercy and how one can put themselves in a position to know that Jesus will advocate on their behalf, or if he has, if this is one of those situations where he really has kind of a dig at these false teachers in mind, or maybe even maybe he's even extending them an olive branch. Hey, you know, I'm targeting you as being utterly wrong in your understanding and in what you're teaching this fellowship, but mercy is there for you. That could be as well. He says, however, if we confess our transgressions, and this could be generally, or it could be he has these false teachers in mind, he has promised to forgive us and cleanse us from all our unrighteousness. Such is his righteousness. I'd like to think that John as an apostle is coming from a position where he has enough magnanimity, you know, to say, look, you know, we're enemies here to the extent of what is most important in reality, the truth from the Father, the truth about life itself. You know, we're coming at this from polar opposite positions, and we're enemies with respect to which side we're advocating from, but I want you to know that mercy is still there for you. There's part of me that wants to believe that is what's behind this statement here, but I just don't know. So you have to make up your own mind. On the other hand, if we claim not to need his mercy, then we make him a liar and his teaching is not in us. So again, he's going back to what Jesus taught, what he is as an apostle, as one who was there, who saw, who heard, is qualified to remind them of. You know, look, if this is what these guys are teaching, they're liars. They're not in a position to teach you. Let me be clear. I'm not writing this to you so that you may feel licensed to sin. Though if anyone should fall to temptation, we have an advocate on our behalf with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. He is the propitiation for our sins, and not only for ours, but for the whole world also. So it was a common accusation against the apostles and what they were teaching, that this whole grace thing was really just a license to sin. I mean, isn't that what you guys are saying? Like, we don't have to worry about living righteously and submitting ourselves to the law and its teaching. And I mean, how many times do the apostles come back to hammering on that point that no, that's not what God wants from us. Grace does not mean that we are free to shine God on and live however we want, live for ourselves. Absolutely not. And so I think he's getting that objection out of the way. He's just clearing that off the table. This is not why I'm saying this. But then he reminds them, but if any of you should be in a situation where you find yourself sinning, it's not the end of the story for you. We have an advocate on our behalf, Jesus Christ the righteous. So I think it's interesting there. I mean, how often he comes back to the centrality of both what they understand, what is the truth from the Father, and how does that look in the life of a believer? It's clear that he's seeing the sort of truth that God is interested in us doing business with as being the sort of truth that you can't just say yes to, like, I think this pew is well designed. It's not that kind of truth, right? It's not the kind of truth that you just agree to and then walk away from, you forget about it the next minute. These are the sort of truths that have deep impact and deep ramifications for our lives, for how we live, for our orientation to reality, our orientation to God himself. These are the kind of truths, existential truths, I think, that John is asking his readers to deal with. And he's going to keep coming back to that. There is this intimate relationship between what they believe and how they live. We're going to see that again and again. I think it's also interesting that he describes at the end of that section Jesus as being the propitiation for not only their sins, and I think there he's probably referring to Jews, but also for the whole world also. So he's reminding these false teachers of the scope of Jesus' life and ministry. That's going to be important later. God's love wasn't restricted simply to his people. God, in sending his son, is going to be a powerful example of the scope and the ground of what love looks like from God's perspective. Because if we as a people are seeking to have fellowship with him, as if we as a people are seeking to emulate him, then our love is going to look like that. It needs to. So he's going to keep that in mind because he's going to come back to that. So I want to end, I think, just by bringing us back to that question of joy. I think this is a huge question and an important thing for us to think about. Is our joy, personally, is our hope set on resembling the Father? Is our hope set on that one day the big problem of my existence is going to be solved? I think if it should be, that's where our joy should be. I think if our joy is set there, then what does that say about us? It says, I think, that we recognize that the great problem of our existence is the fact that even though I was made in the image of God, that I resemble him so little. That my own sin and brokenness cuts me off from him. It puts me in a position of enmity with God, where I deserve judgment. And that's tragic, because we were made for glory. So to find your joy in the promise that one day I can be made in his image in a way that's utterly unlike how I am now, in a way that solves that problem, where I'm not going to get in my own way anymore. I'm not going to hurt myself and others. I'm not going to chafe against the truth. I'm not going to be resistant to what God wants of me and wants to teach me. That I would want my joy, that my joy would be that, says that I take that seriously about myself, right? And if my joy is that, then it says that I take seriously that that's real, that God's promised that, and that he's going to fulfill that promise. I mean, that's what faith is, isn't it? It's taking seriously the promises of God and that they are real and they will come to pass one day. And that those promises have a significant, life-changing, life-determining meaning for myself. And that I'm going to orient my life around that. That's where our joy should be. And I think it's significant that John wants his readers to have that joy as well. He wants his readers to have their joy be centered on that promise, and that he wants that fulfilled for them. We should want that for one another. We should want that from one another such that we don't treat it as neither here nor there to me whether or not you end up in the kingdom. I think it should be of interest to us that one another, you and I, you guys end up in the kingdom too. And that should inform how we treat one another, that we advocate for the truth on one another's behalf, that we want life and goodness for each other. Okay, got a couple of minutes for questions. Anybody have any?
So listening to the this issue with Diotrephes, mm-hmm. and Jewish John writing to address it, I'm wondering if this is somehow similar to the Jewish-Gentile tensions from the early church, because there were issues going on, as described in the book, mm-hmm. of Acts. And I'm wondering if this is maybe less detailed to the story, but I'm wondering if it's a similar situation. Because mm-hmm. Diotrephes is Jewish. He sounds Greek. Mm-hmm. So it was just a thought and a wondering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's hard to say what the makeup of this church was, how much it was Greek, how much of it was Jewish. But it seems clear that, at the very least, whether they were Jew or Greek, they had a significant understanding of the Old Testament and of the Mosaic Covenant. And there must have been some cultural pressure on them that would have made some of what these false teachers was advocating for compelling in some way. There's a lot that John doesn't say in this letter, but it makes sense to me that because he doesn't go into the law or the covenant, he doesn't go into what it was Jesus taught, beyond simply by capturing it as the truth and that they need to love one another in various ways. It makes sense to me that they must have had that understanding in common, that they already had that information there. So, it doesn't seem to me that it's exactly the same question, that it's not about, Gentile believers that need to convert to Judaism, but that there's something more significant about what they're claiming about Jesus himself, what he was and what he wasn't, that's at the heart of what's going on here.
The word fellowship is used, I think, four times, mm-hmm. in this passage. Would you translate as commonality?
Would I?
Yeah. Oh, the gist of it?
Well, there's going to be a commonality in that they're going to share the truth in common. But it seems that fellowship is a little more technical than just having commonality. It's that you resemble what you have fellowship with. I think there, he's going to talk about how those who have, fellowship with the Father resemble are children of God, and they are going to resemble him in certain ways. And he's going to talk about, these people, these false teachers, resembling the spirit of Antichrist, and that's what they have fellowship with. So I think there's something more going on than just that they share something in common.
Okay, so that you, the audience, will have fellowship with us, John and the apostles.
Mm-hmm.
Because our fellowship as we apostles is with the Father, in fact, with his Son, Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And then later he says, so if we say we have fellowship with him and walk in darkness, is he talking about we the apostles? Is he offering them up sort of as a saying, we the apostles are not some particular breed of cat? We too have to go before the Father and confess our sins. We too have to count on him for salvation.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because over the years, I've heard these things debated back and forth that, well, he's speaking ours collectively. But if I read that as he is sort of baring his breast to the to the audience, he is saying, okay, we claim to love the Father and to want to emulate the Father, but if we don't do that, then we don't. Then we're not. And in fact, if we say we have no sin, we're liars.
Yeah, I mean, he wouldn't say that this criteria that he's leveling at the false teachers doesn't apply to him as well.
Right, right.
It's simply that if you look at me, if you look at us as the apostles and you look at the false teachers with the same lenses, right, you're going to see two different things. But the same reality is going to apply to both of us.
And so he says, if we say we have not sinned, we make him a liar and his word is not in us. And he goes on to say that Jesus died not just for our sins, but for the sins of the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
That might be an echo of the Jew-Gentile issue, that we, the Jewish apostles, we're all Jewish, sin is sin. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter if you're an apostle. It doesn't matter if you're Jewish. But the beauty of it is Jesus died for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But it's if I forget what I've been taught growing up and say that this is John, when he uses the personal pronoun, he's laying themselves out as being no different than anyone else in their way they have to be saved, and that they are just human beings, and that everybody, like you said, look at everybody with the same lenses. Everybody fits under this proviso. Jesus is the only way. And he's just sort of celebrating that they've been there and that he wants them to be there too.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I think you're right. Okay, it's time. I got to let you guys go. Thanks again. And next week we will keep going and see if we can get through chapter 2.